right there?
That's okay.
So I'm experimenting with language and the Dharma, and you're part of my experiment, and I picked these three words, these three verbs, these three sensibilities that I feel are very much embedded in the Dharma and in form and in temple arts, which is what I travel and teach. So they're not that different, and I invite you to explore for yourself the differences and the likenesses between the three words. Last week being offer, this week notice, and the last week, next Wednesday, gift. And while I was sitting zazen tonight, I was thinking, how do these fit together? You know, what kind of an entity do they make? And does one come first? And I was thinking, and this is a question, sometimes is gift the last? Is notice and offering interchangeable? If you offer something, have you noticed? If you notice something, do you offer? And then when is the gift verb? Where does that happen? And I found this wonderful story. So one of the things I like to do when I travel is to dig into the library and the art scene of the place that I'm at. And you have just a treasure hold here. First of all, your library, I discovered a book that I had never read or never seen. And I just returned it tonight back to the library. And I have some comments from that. And as well, the art scene here, going to the Vancouver Art Gallery and the Museum of Anthropology. And it's just rich with lots and lots of material. And so I try to fold that in, as well as realizing that Kate was a translator for a book of poetry. And so that will become apparent. I try to kind of mix these things that I discover as well as what I brought with me in my suitcase. So I wanted to share this story that Suzuki Roshi commented about, and I feel that it has to do with noticing. And it's from a book that I borrowed here called To Shine One Corner, Suzuki Roshi Phrases. Suzuki Roshi washed his feet on the doorstep after working in the garden. His attendant, who was standing just inside the door, handed him a towel. She then reached down and pinched one of his toes. "That is one of the powers of the Buddha," he said. "What is?" "To see what someone needs and give it to them." Let me read that once more, because it has a kind of an odd twist to it. He had been working in the garden. He washed his feet. And at City Center, we do actually have a basin where traditionally you wash your feet before you enter the Zendo. It's kind of a relic at this point, but it is a nice idea. And his attendant, who was standing just inside the door, handed him a towel. She then reached down and pinched one of his toes. "That is one of the powers of the Buddha," he said. "What is?" "To see what someone needs and give it to them." So when I read that story, what came up for me was, well, I just assumed she was going to dry his feet. Like there was a towel, wet feet, and isn't that what's really apparent? He's got wet feet and they need to be dried. But no, that wasn't what happened at all. She reached down and she pinched his toe. Now, as to what he needed, what she observed, what she or he noticed, that's not necessarily completely apparent in the story. But the exchange is very real. And I have my own story about Suzuki Roshi's wife. It happened one time when I was in Japan. I went to visit her. And by then, she was a very old woman. And I wasn't even sure in that visit that I would actually see her, because she had been very ill and she was very old. But one day, I was having lunch with Shingo's wife, and we were sitting having noodles, and there was a phone call, and the call was, come now, you know, so you can have a conversation with Mitsui. And so we went to the house, and she was quite ill, but very friendly, and we had a lovely visit, and it was very moving. And of course, as I entered the household, I took my shoes off, and because we'd been hiking all day, I had on those, you know, shoes that lace up. So as we were leaving the household, and we were at the door departing, I bent down, I was kind of struggling with my shoelaces, and suddenly I felt this waft of air and a pair of hands tying my shoes. She had knelt down to tie my shoes. This old woman who was ill, who I didn't know well. And it so touched me. I could hardly stand up afterwards. It was so tender. She just saw what was needed, and she completely, wholeheartedly did what she felt was, she noticed something and she made an offering. And it's something that I'll never forget this. And I share it with you as maybe my own personal story around this idea of noticing and offering. So one of the precursors to all three of these verbs is to become aware. Kind of awake, aware, you know, the big A words. To perceive, to discern. And tonight on the Zafu, you had a chance, perhaps, to notice your mind, to notice what was going on when you sat on the cushion, and then perhaps to, once you noticed, to see what then happened next. So there is a sense of relief. This is what Bayes says about noticing. That noticing is in the Pali is pana, or wisdom. So last week was citta, and this week is pana. So this wisdom, so when you notice, when you actually are able to notice, there's a relief. There's a certain kind of wisdom that's connected to that ability, that sensibility of noticing. And in order to actually notice, as with these two stories, there's a selflessness. There is an attention to what your habit is. And if you can actually step away from the habit and honestly be awake and aware and notice what is going on right at that moment. This notice, this sense of being able to notice, also includes a spacious mind, an open mind, a mind that's receptive, a mind that is not occupied, but is actually available. And in temple arts, actually almost every one of the temple arts requires you to notice. But the three that I wrote down for tonight are the three that we will do this weekend for those of you that are coming to the workshop: Chibana, Sujiki, and Way of Tea. And these are all different forms of temple arts that involve notice, being able to notice. Another place that I find it happens, and that I suggest as a possible place for you to practice, is the art of folding. So, you know, folding's kind of the rage right now. I don't know how it is here in Canada, but there's this book about Tidy or Tiny or something like that. You know, it's a woman who's developed this whole theory around keeping a minimal household. Does that ring a bell for anybody? And then what you do with the objects of things that you have. And she talks a lot about the notion that actually to hang something is kind of insulting to the object, and that it's a much more tender and caring activity to actually fold something. And I once asked my teacher, before this book came out, I said, why do we fold the way we do? Why do we fold our robes? Why do we fold our rakusu this way? And she said, well, I think it's because we didn't have an iron. And we both kind of laughed about that. But then actually, when we started to dig into it, we realized that we both really enjoyed handling and tenderly caring for whatever it was we were folding. So in temple arts, there are many times in which we actually have the ritual of folding. You have all had the ritual in Orioki of folding your cloths. And if you wear any of these ceremonial garments, you have been taught and you regularly fold them in a particular way. In fact, so much so that, you know, they start to have their own life, right? They have their own, they actually show us how to fold because there's a history. There's a history. So folding is not invisible. It's something that remains, and it's something that is a part of the memory of the thing that you're handling. So one of the things you can do this week, if you like, and I always like to have kind of, because this is everyday practice, I try to make a suggestion of something that you can carry and take home. So one of the things I encourage you to do is to notice, maybe to decide on a thing, an object or a piece of clothing, something that is regularly used by you, and fold it every day. Just fold it every day. Just take a moment, take a breath, and then fold it. And see what you notice, see what calls your attention, and then what happens after. So the what happens after is really important. So noticing is like psychoanalysis, you know, like you can say, well, I'm neurotic, but then like what? You know, like, so you notice something, you may name it, you may notice it, but then what happens after? Is there an action? Is there a feeling? What is it that actually happens? And to keep track of that, because it won't always be the same. I guarantee you that if you fold something every day, probably every day is going to be different. I hope so, for your benefit and for all of our benefits. One of the things that happens with this notice, being able to notice, and again with all these verbs, is that these words in a way ask for an action, but it's a physicality. It's a physical sensibility. And it can be around an object, it can be around a person, it can be around a situation. So I have another story from Suzuki Roshi that I think also exemplifies this idea of notice. And it has a little different edge to it. So let's see how this one plays out. A student asked Suzuki Roshi why the Japanese make their teacups so thin and delicate that they break easily. He said, It's not that they are too delicate, he answered, but that you don't know how to handle them. You must adjust yourself to the environment and not vice versa. Has anybody ever had that experience? No? Maybe?
Which experience?
So that whole idea, and that's one of the reasons that we in the practice tend to hold everything with two hands, is to care for it, to actually acknowledge that it's both sacred and it's fragile, and to maybe accept or notice what are the qualities of this thing or this person or this situation, and how might I respond, what happens after I notice, that will be helpful, that will actually be a way of practicing that has to do with diminishing suffering.
I have an example.
Sorry?
I have an example.
Oh, good.
So I had to learn in using a Japanese teacup without a handle that you don't fill it all the way to the top, or it will be too hot.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
So if you do as the Japanese do and only fill it maybe two-thirds full, this is not for tea ceremony, this is ordinary green tea, then you can kind of rest it in one hand so you're not holding the hot sides, and then lift it from that thinner curved upper part, and it's not hot there. So, you can kind of go like this.
So I like that. I like that try. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that if we're used to, you can fill a teacup with a handle much fuller.
Yeah, and that also brings up the whole, thank you for that story, and what when I hear that, I think of the whole idea of having a liquid in a container that doesn't have a handle. You know, it doesn't have a designated place, right, to actually...
So you have to learn how to use your hands.
Yeah. A teacher once told me, when I asked, why do we drink tea out of a bowl? She said that she was told that it teaches you patience. So often when you're served a bowl of something and you have to handle it, you have both the technique that Kate has mentioned, and also there's the sensibility of having to wait a little bit until it's just right. So tonight we're going to break up again into triads, or threes or fours. We'll see what the numeric situation is here. But we're not going to be silent tonight. So here's what we're going to do. So I brought, I'm studying ancient trees on this trip. and I'm making a tree map, actually, as I travel from center to center. And I found a tree that had a lot of pine cones under it. So they're all of one species. And each group will get a pine cone. And the pine cone is a facilitator. If you want to, you can talk about the pine cone in terms of what you notice. But as well, I offer to you to talk about something that happened in the course of your day where you were aware of noticing. And the two questions that I want you to entertain in your group, so this is a deep listening group in which one person talks, the others listen, there's no cross-talking, and whatever the talking is within the group does not leave the group. It stays in the context of that group when the group is finished. So here are the two questions. What calls your attention? What happens after? What calls your attention? What happens after? So I'll keep track of the time, and we'll do this in the same way that I think is the tradition here on Wednesday nights. And I'll ring a bell I'll ring a bell for each person, for each section of the triad. And we'll see how many groups we are, but I think it'll be, or you'll have about 3 minutes for each person, 4 minutes for each person. Okay. All right. So please cluster with the two other people around you.
I've forgotten the two questions.
What called your attention?
So, I have enough for, I think, for 10 groups. I have one more here.
We have two.
Okay, perfect.
Oh, there's another. Yeah.
There. Then we're all even group threes.
Is that too weird?
Thank you. I think I'm sorry. It's,
Hey. Right, everyone has something?
Oh, one thing is to, before you start, introduce yourselves, say your names to each other.
Okay.
Could you repeat those?
Okay, so the request was made to repeat the questions. So the two questions are, and this can be about the object that's been passed out to the group or to something in the course of your day. What calls your attention or called your attention? What happens or happened after? Okay.
So today, I had a sort of kind of release of pine cones. I was walking home and I just kind of lost my thoughts. Not really paying attention to what was kind of going on around me. And I walked past a tree and there was an overhanging branch in the face. So I'm not sure if it was a tree of pine cone or not. Probably not because it had like a longer branch. But I guess what called my attention in that case.
I'm noticing actually a reaction.
I've already noticed that, other than
I miss So trigger the memory. There's a perception trigger in my past, and then a reminiscence, and then also a longing for sort of a simple time where I go enjoy and also like worry things which I just pass over now. I realize it wasn't the first thing. So I'm noticing kind of like literally weaving now. My lack of noticing is very sort of thing.
Last time I was on the same day, walked home,
there's a crow. I don't even know what a pine cone really does. They look but they're complex. I also don't know how they work. And I regret that I've gone all this time never investigating what was so fun when I was like,
It's always fun. I was at the end of my work day and I was like, I have one more portrait.
It's a mystery.
I could feel my brain. Essentially like fighting against maybe like we're tired. I can feel the tiredness. I can feel like cognitive fatigue of my brain. And that was like very like obvious in all my body. That's like all that. And afterwards,
I'm not ready for reports.
I think spacious under. Then I realized that I really like enjoyed it. I might just be having to show on a time. I think it might be sounds and
walk lunch with a close colleague or work friend
I noticed something very unusual for them, which was that today was the first time I started in high school. Today was the first time we had a morning session. And so I had to get up.
And I just found myself really appreciating.
I had a much harder time coming here this evening. I took a new route and I thought it would be faster. And so I guess going back to the first, but it was quite good to wake up early and have plans for the work. I'm not going to do that.
Okay, so let's just scoot around. You can kind of stay where you are, but maybe face this direction. So we have a little time for comments, questions, inquiries. And then I want to give you one more Suzuki Roshi quote before we close for the evening. So, yes?
What kind of tree is it?
What kind of tree is it? Does anybody know?
I see the needles.
Yeah, we need to see the needles.
Which means it's a fir cone.
It's not a pine.
No. Because I remember the fir trees have the little mouse tails. It's like a little mouse is going in each little seed pod.
So the signifier on this is the little pieces that are coming off the pine cone, the little feathers. Yeah, is that what you noticed?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so what kind of tree do you think this is?
Well, I thought it was fir, but I think everything is fir.
Okay, it's a fir, but not a Douglas fir. It's not a hemlock, it's not a cedar, and it's not a pine. So it's a mystery.
So bring the answer back next week. Unless someone has a definitive one here.
I'll have an answer for you Saturday.
All right, then. You can keep that one because that has lots of clues on it.
Lab
more
sample.
Than this one.
A shelf load of field guides.
Good. All right. Thank you for that question. Other comments or questions or anything with.
I notice hummingbird. We have a hummingbird feeder outside our sunroom, which is where we eat all our meals at this in this season. And there are two different species of hummingbirds that come, male and female, and young ones. And every time I see one, I smile. Mm-hmm. There are these little bursts of iridescent energy, and they're just
yes.
nothing like them.
Yeah. Oh, lovely. It's a nice story and a nice experience of the quality of noticing and then what happens after you notice something. Did yes, Jonathan.
If you truly notice something, is there a gap between the noticing and then the appropriate response? Or is the noticing and the appropriate response like a seamless unity?
That's a really deep question, a good question, and I can give you what my answer would be tonight. So there's a couple things that jump up for me in what you said. One was appropriate, and the other was gap. So I was once instructed by a senior teacher that if you see some suffering, don't hesitate. Now, tonight, we're not necessarily talking about that. We're talking about noticing. So I think that rather than gap, I might say pause. So, you know, we're all kind of struggling with mind and body kind of, you know, being close together. And so sometimes the pause is that there isn't necessarily that, you know, they're not necessarily living closely together, the mind and body. And so sometimes the pause can both be thoughtfulness. It can also be your intellect coming in and saying what would be appropriate. So that's a great question for you to go home with, which is when you notice something, what happens next? And so if you fill it in with a story, if you notice, if you something happens, you know, like my rakusu isn't straight, and then I straightened it. But if I went, oh, my rakusu isn't straight, oh, I wonder what my teacher would think, and oh, it's not going to be folded right, and you know, I could start to like expand the gap, mind the gap, you know. I don't know if you have that expression here when you get on the metro, but it's a big in the States, it's mind the gap, you know. So that gap can expand because I'm making all these stories around what happened and my noticing. So there's room there to extend the whole thing or to bring it very close together. And ideally, we want it like Gassho. You know, we want to have that much space, but that's very hard to do. So, is that helpful?
Yes, very much so.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Before Zazen, we offer incense, and there's a text that we read, and I actually happen to offer the incense tonight myself.
I heard your voice. Yeah.
At the end of it, there are two sentences that, now that I'm thinking, it's just a great example of noticing and what happens after. It says, may we awaken from forgetfulness and realize our true home. Now, awakening from forgetfulness, isn't that a great example of noticing?
Mm-hmm. So the phrase is awakening from...
May we awaken from forgetfulness.
May we awaken from forgetfulness.
And realize our true home.
And realize our true home.
Simply, my question is, when we awaken from forgetfulness, isn't that a great example of noticing that we actually were forgetful? Mm-hmm. So we are awakening.
Yes, I could see it resonating in that way. It's there are a lot of strong words in there, and the forgetful means there was something remembered at some point, but has been forgotten, as opposed to a brand new discovery. So yeah, noticing something's been forgotten, and then what comes up, yeah. Yeah, I think that that's a lovely way to weave this idea of this verb into the liturgy, you know, the sutras and the things we chant and the things we read. Because notice isn't actually, you know, it's not a word. I don't think that it's actually literally in a sutra, but it the sensibility of it, it is like what you just described. Yeah. Thank you. Patrick. Oh, was that?
Sure, yes.
Oh, was that? I thought you were asking.
I was just wondering what your thoughts might be on, you know, I find that sometimes when I'm trying to practice being, you know, noticing or being mindful, I can fall very easily into a kind of preference for what is worth noticing and what is not worth noticing. And I feel that I think I feel closest to my practice when my noticing is without preference, when it's noticing the things that are not, you know, when we talk about the arts, you know, I think, okay, I'm practicing my calligraphy. Mm-hmm. Well, it's very, for me, it's very easy to be noticing because my brushes are beautiful, the characters are beautiful, and I feel in my practice I'm called to notice, you know, the homeless in the east side, and often I feel very drawn not to notice, to right. look ahead and not to be aware of that, or to notice, you know, the mess that's left in my workplace by yeah. a party over the weekend.
Right.
How do I create a practice out of noticing the mundane, the not special?
Such a good question. I'm not sure I have a satisfying answer for you. I think what comes up for me when you ask that is wholehearted, 100%, deeply, sincerely practicing. And preferences get in the way. Habits, as I mentioned earlier, get in the way. I was having a conversation with someone this morning about the notion of comfort, and comfort gets in the way, right? So being aware that your preferences are present that's extremely helpful, and then noticing what happens, noticing and then noticing what happens. And so it isn't a yellow brick road, you know, it isn't like ka-chink, ka-chink, ka-chink. It's one step at a time. So noticing, and then a preference may start to, you know, elbow you a little bit, but you have the possibility of saying, oh, there's a preference, and then going on with your response. And for myself, I'll just say that for me, that's hard for me, because I have lots of preferences. And so I usually have to slow down. And I remember when I first started practicing intensely, I went to visit my granddaughter, and she said, "Booby, you talk so slow now." You know, and it was because I was trying, you know, preferences, habits, you know, I was trying to move forward in a right way, you know. Mm-hmm. So I think the fact that you asked that question, you're most of the way there. So I encourage you. Thank you. Michael, I saw you earlier with your hand.
I think the word notice is very interesting. And you're right, I don't recall it very much in, you know, reading the sutras or people talk about the practice. But it occurred to me, you know, we can only notice if we're in the present moment. If we're fully there, we notice, or we see. Otherwise, we can't. And maybe this is getting to Pat's point, too, you know, like, when I have a preference or I'm distracted, I can't notice.
Yeah.
I really can't notice. Or because I'm too caught up in whatever else is going on in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, noticing is zazen.
Mm-hmm.
Just zazen.
Yes.
And we see what arises before us.
Yeah.
And I believe there is a gap between noticing and then a response to it. There's a fine gap or maybe a larger gap. And for me, what came up was today, I saw the neighbor's cat, very beautiful gray cat. And we have a part of our yard that we have fenced off with bird feeders to keep the cats away. And I saw him inside the fence, where the bird feeders are, hiding under a bush. And then he saw me and he came out. He's very friendly. And he, in one leap, leaped over this 3-foot high fence. And my first thought was, how beautiful. My second thought was, damn.
Oh, I love that image. I love that image of the cat flying over and you're going, oh. And we don't know what the birds were doing at that moment, right?
Originally they weren't there, but I...
Oh, that's
a beautiful descriptor of the human predicament of consciousness, and then through consciousness, responsibility.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, we're the ones who choose to feed the birds. We're the ones who choose to have cats.
Right.
And
that's right. Yeah.
And then it is, you know, then incumbent upon us to pay attention.
Yeah, it's the minute we play with nature, then we have a responsibility. Yeah, and the other thing that came up, and I love that story, is that this is hard. This practice. Sometimes at the end of the day, I am just exhausted, and I actually haven't done much, except maybe be available. Whatever that word means, you know? But sometimes, just like my friends now, they go, like, you never do anything at night anymore, Marcia. And I just, like, I'm too tired. You know, I'm just like, it's been a full day, whatever it is, you know? I think that's a wonderful place for us to mind the gap. And I did want to share this story with you, and then I think we can go for the back room. So this again is another Suzuki Roshi comment. Once when talking about going to the beach and looking out at the ocean, Suzuki Roshi reflected, if you're alert, you can hear the tide turn. Once when talking about going to the beach and looking out at the ocean, Suzuki Roshi reflected, if you're alert, you can hear the tide turn. I think that's a good place for us too. And thank you so much. You're welcome to keep the unknown pine cone, or cone. Yeah. Okay. To be determined.
That's good.
So maybe